Welcome back to Vinyl Final. I'm your host, Heather McGee, and today we are talking to Creative Operations Pro, Jill Ryan. Hi, everyone. I am so pleased to welcome my former colleague and current role model, Jill Lyons, to this podcast. A little bit more about Jill, and she can fill you in on anything that I might miss here, but she has had an incredible career. She is a strategic creative operations leader and award-winning executive producer and writer. Right now, she's leading creative operations at Maximum Effort, Ryan Reynolds' creative engine. However, she's also had many other incredible roles. Prior to her current position, she was EVP of Delivery at Hawkeye Agency, Head of Creative Agency Operations for Allstate, VP of Business Operations and Production at Epsilon, and originally, which is where she and I met many moons ago, she was a part of the legendary team at Harpo Studios, working as a writer, a producer, a marketer, and branded entertainment pro for OWN, the Oprah Winfrey Network, The Dr. Oz Show, and The Oprah Winfrey Show. You've done a lot.
Oh my gosh. It sounds like a lot.
Are you impressed with yourself with it all said out loud? I was like, wow, I have done a lot.
Yes. Well, thank you for having me. So excited to chat today.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have you on. I've wanted to have Jill on for quite a while. And I'm so glad we were able to figure out our schedules and make it work. Maybe to start off, Jill, you know, I kind of gave the broad strokes of your career. Is there anything you want to fill in or voice over about kind of what you've seen, what you have experienced throughout your career and some of the things that you've done that you think would be good for people to know about you?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think you hit on most of the highlights of my career. You know, in addition to that, I am a mom. So parenting is probably one of the greatest leadership boot camps that you can have. I love, as you mentioned, to write. So I spent a lot of time around Second City here in Chicago, writing, occasionally performing some comedy stuff. Let's see what else. I'm a certified yoga teacher, which is a fun fact. Mm-hmm. And probably, you know, first and foremost, a forever student. I love academia and academics. I love studying kind of psychology and sociology and the intersection of all of those things that motivate us, the wisdom traditions of, you know, Christianity and Buddhism and yogi stuff and woo-woo stuff. And I could go on and on, but certainly I contain multitudes like most people.
Yeah, you do. Well, one of the things I love about you, because I am very lucky to be privy to a lot of the projects that Jill's working on. And a lot of things I love about you is that while you have a very, what I have to imagine is a very busy career job, you know, main focus, but then you're also so involved in personal passions that you also just go in, it would appear to me, head first, really taking the bull by the horns and really doing as much as you can with it. And I relate to that. And I love that. And you were just, I think sometimes people make their career their whole person, and you clearly have a lot of different interests and in all different kinds of ways. And I just think that's really great.
Thank you. Yeah. I think it's really important that, you know, your full self is always kind of getting fed and watered, right? And the career and job is a part of that and a big part of that. And on a sliding scale, I mean, I think I've been so lucky to have a career that does fill me up creatively, that I just wake up and I'm excited every day to do my job and to do work, to the point where it doesn't feel like work. Mm-hmm. It feels like play most of the time. But I also recognize that, you know, that has been a journey. That's not everyone's experience, nor is that what everyone should chase, right? We are full, whole people. And I think it was Jane Fonda who was saying, you know, we're not supposed to be perfect. We're supposed to be whole. I think she said that on the Oprah show. Most of my quotes come from Oprah, as I'm sure you also know. Like, it's just deep. 25 years of the show is embedded in all of our brains. But I think that was an Oprah episode where she said, you know, we're just supposed to be here and whole. We're not supposed to be perfect. And what a gift is that? Because you can do so much more with that than trying to chase this perfection.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this a few times to friends, working with Oprah, while she is an incredible leader, it was the opportunity of a lifetime equally, I think, because of the access we had to all of these incredible leaders, incredible people, you know, that have so much to share. And I know I walked away with so much wisdom and learning from every day just from being around these people that have achieved such incredible things in the world. And you're right. It like seeps into your soul and it's just there. And most of the things that I think about at times, like, oh, well, they were on the Oprah show and they were talking about this. It's kind of
so
funny.
It's so true.
I love it. Well, diving in. So we're going to talk about a few things today. We're going to talk about leadership. We're going to talk about craft. And we're going to talk a little bit about DEI, which are all things that Jill knows quite a bit about and is passionate about. And so I'm excited to chat about these things. And to get started on a leadership front, now, all of us who work in brand storytelling, we have all dealt with trying to get an idea we really believe in or a strategy to the finish line. However, we also know that as a part of our world, it's always a constant struggle dealing with so much feedback. Everyone has opinions. And as a leader, how do you think about keeping a good creative idea alive?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that you can't kill a good creative idea, right? Because it inherently will get out somewhere. It just might not be in the form that you think that it's going to be, you know? And I think there's two sides to that answer. First, from the creator's side, right? There's that old adage. I don't even know if that's the right way to set up this whatever I'm going to say, metaphor, I guess. But, you know, that thing that's like, you know, when you ask God for something, there are three answers. Yes, not yet. And I have something better in mind.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the same thing with creativity, right? Like, it's never a no. When it comes from this place of like authentic creation, what's something that's true to you, something that's a piece of you. But it might not be the right time for it to come out into the world, or the right format, or you think it's a book, but it's a movie, or you think it's a, you think it's a movie, but it's a tweet. Like, honestly, like you just, it's not really our job to judge the final product of it. And I think it's very hard for us as producers, forever producers, to, you know, or I should say it's easy for us to edit ourselves out of what the thing is going to be because we want to control it so much. You know, and instead just letting it be out in the world and seeing what it might become and being curious about that is, to me, I have found a better way to seed and plant, you know, my own personal creative projects, ideas, endeavors, etc. Now, I think the other side of that question is, as a leader, how do you kind of usher in and encourage creative work to come out? And I think, you know, that is a skill in and of itself, right? Because you're almost kind of like midwifing this thing that's coming into the world. You know, and when it's your job to both be a gatekeeper or a toll boother, and also a midwife or a guide, you know, it can be really hard to strike that balance, right? And I think that's where, you know, when you look at historically or traditional, like kind of who has dictated what a good creative idea is and who has been that gatekeeper to create, to greenlight those stories wherever they are, whether that's advertising or Hollywood or whatever, you know, we've had a history of a very small group of people who have been able to do that. And I think right now in 2023, where we are with technology, where we are with, you know, conversations in society and just where we're moving as a human people, it's never been a better time to be a content creator. And so then as a leader, gosh, it's like, the job is not to block the work. The job is not to say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way. The job is to understand and learn from a perspective that is different from your own, but that is also super relatable to you. Like, what's the nugget of something that you want to co-create, you know, and add to and be additive and positive? And I think that, you know, that idea, just taking that intention and orientation of, what am I here to push forward? how am I here to accelerate and move work forward versus what am I here to like cut off and block and say, no, that's a terrible idea. Now there are bad creative ideas.
That whole thing of
good creative ideas. So
that whole like thing about there are no bad ideas. I'm like, I think there are. There
exactly,
are some bad ideas out there.
There are definitely bad ideas.
But you're making me think of, you know, like some of the best leaders I've ever worked with, you know, what stood out to me about them is that their perspective was definitely to strengthen the idea. And they would ask lots of questions so that they really understood the approach. They really understood the strategy. And they would ask questions to push the team to understand their own ideas better, to fill it out, to get detailed, to get granular, to really pressure test the boundaries of the idea
yeah,
and
I
make
love
it
that.
Really strong. And there is such a difference between that kind of a leader and someone who was more of a firing squad situation,
yeah,
like poking
100%.
Holes in it. And it just weakens the idea instead of being additive, truly collaborative and working together to up-level what we're talking about here. So I
yep.
love that. And that's what that makes me think about. It's so funny. Working creative is so funny because we've all worked on so many things that your just heart was just on it and you felt so good about it. And then it dies in 30 seconds. We've all had those heartbreak stories.
We've all had those heartbreaks. And I think, you know, the other lens through which, you know, we all have to come to terms with as applied creatives who work in business is that it's applied. It's not an art gallery or a documentary film that you've self-produced and put out into the world. You are doing it for a business purpose. And so you have to get comfortable with it not being exactly how you thought it was going to be when it was first birthed to you, unless you want to go do that. Like, but then you go do your painting and your stage shows and your, you know, your other place. Like, have you read The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron?
You know, it's been on my shelf for so long.
Oh,
and
it's
I've
a
never read it.
It's a good read. She talks about being shadow artists, and she talks about, you know, a lot of times, like, you know, we find ourselves in these creative professions because we're inherently creative people, but because it's an applied art, you know, and because of, you know, business and capitalism, like there's other factors to it. And when you're really good at that whole kind of business and capitalism and applied art, you tend to quiet that shadow artist in yourself who just wants to make art for art's sake. And, you know, she kind of gives you permission to do that and says, you know, you can do a painting just because you want to do a painting. It doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't have to sell to anybody.
Yeah.
Nobody at work needs to see it. You know,
you
can still kind of feed that part of you. And, you know, and I think that's like, gosh, it's such a gift, again, to be able to be in a creative profession where we get to like do this every day and use those skills. And also it's a good reminder to say like, yeah, it's also okay to just like write poetry because you want to write poetry. And that's nourishing and feeds you, you know, and really, I think is beneficial to your professional life.
I totally agree. I know you have many personal passions. I also have personal passions, you know, because I think to your point, I think it actually makes me better at work having all kinds of, you know, painting, writing, personal projects that I work on that are totally mine. And there's no business strategy behind them. I'm just doing them because I think they are beautiful or wonderful or impactful in a purely artistic manner. And I think it makes me better at work. And a lot of times with my teams, I do suggest that if they don't do that already, look, you have this passion and it doesn't exactly fit in right here, right now at work, but you should do that in your personal life. And then we can figure out what that looks like here too, when we're working towards a business outcome and we have to connect strategy to this great artistic skill that you have, and we have to connect the dots here at work. But in your personal life, you can do whatever you want, and it can just be art for art's sake. And I think for most creative people, having those two routes present in their life is really helpful.
Right. Yep. Couldn't agree more.
So what has been you've been leading teams for a while now, because you are a senior point in your career. What has been for you your greatest leadership lesson?
So I was a camp counselor for several summers.
I love it.
And I am the most camp counselor person you will ever meet. shout out to Camp Tecumseh, which is in Brookston, Indiana. wonderful independent Y camp that I'm on the board of currently. And, you know, just spend a lot of time with the alumni board, and but my kids go to camp. Everything I learned from leadership, I learned at Camp Tecumseh, truly. And it's crazy to me because, like I said, I was, you know, 16, 17, 18 when I was working there. But I tell you, those leadership lessons have stayed with me. And I think, gosh, there's a couple, but the biggest one is counsel with your feet. That's what we used to say. So like, if you're at the soccer field and you see kids doing something that they're not supposed to do or something that's unsafe, you could yell, "Hey, stop doing that," right? Or you could walk over there and get down on their level. That was another thing they always taught us, to get down on the level of the child, look them in the eye, make sure that they're listened to and heard, and that they hear you, right? And then there was always this, like, kind of feeds into the second lesson, teachable moment. Let's go from the soccer field and go to lifeguarding, because I think that's a better analogy, right? You could whistle blow and say, "Don't run." Or you could say, "Hey guys, let's try walking. It's safer. I don't want you to slip and hurt yourself." So you've corrected the negative behavior, you've given a positive something, and you've given them a reason why. And like, it sounds so simple, but it truly changed the environment. And I think what I learned at like a place like Camp Tecumseh, which ultimately led into my like love for branding, and not just storytelling, but like creating an experience for people, is that when you have these really intentional kind of ways of being and ways of conducting yourself, you really have an opportunity to create a community and an environment that operates differently than you know, how you might expect it to, or how you might think it to. Like, think of the public pool, what it's like whistleblowing and don't run, and hey, one more of this and you're going to get out of the pool, and all of that kind of stuff, versus, oh, you know what, why don't you go on the diving board first, why don't you go, like, it's just a community of thoughtfulness and intentionality. And I feel like, you know, we really tried, and the counselors there now, because like I said, I'm still involved, are still, you know, the best counselors in the country. I'm going to say I'm biased. But really having those leadership lessons at an early age, and then what a great way to work on them, but with children, right? Yeah. And not saying that you should treat your employees like children or your teammates or colleagues. But we're all just, you know, we're all just kids in big bodies, right? With the same kind of like needs and desires for community, belonging. Gosh, I could go on and on about my camp leadership lessons, because truly I use them all every day.
Yeah. Well, from what you're saying, it sounds like the difference between essentially shutting someone down and routing them to something that's better. Like that's the difference there.
Yes.
Yeah. You're just making me think about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because, you know, we talk a lot about leadership with like feedback, and, you know, if you don't do it in the moment, it's really hard, really hard. Like, imagine that scenario with the kid running at the pool, and then like 5 hours later, you're like, "Hey, let's talk about how you were running at the pool 5 hours ago." Like, what? The kid's on to archery or like something else, but you know, like, in the moment. And then there was a beautiful experience I had at camp with my daughter, who this was a couple of years ago, but there was like a rock climbing wall. We were there for family camp one weekend, and she's like trying to climb the rock wall, and she was scared, really scared to do it. She was like 6 at the time, maybe. And she tried it, and she tried it for like 2 feet, and then she was like, "I'm done."
She tried it though. That's awesome.
She tried it. And you know what? The camp counselor, God bless him, he was like, "I am so proud of you, because you got up so high." He said, "And you know what else you did? You tried it. And then you said when it was enough. And I'm really proud of you for understanding that you can try something and that you can stop something." And it was just like, oh my God, this is like, this is like a leadership lesson, and this kid's like a 16-year-old kid who's just got it. Like, that kid could be a CEO someday because of that, the pep talk that he gave my 6-year-old, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's so many lessons in one moment. I mean, I know this is a little bit off topic and we'll get back on here in a second, but it makes me think about, I mean, the art of knowing when to quit or when you have gotten as far as you need to go, that's a real skill too. Cause I think,
oh yeah.
And maybe this is from my background as a TV producer, cause that was my first real job. And so I think kind of imprints things on you that you take the rest of your career. So I don't know if you feel this way, but there's part of me, it's like, this has to happen and it is going to happen and I'm going to make it happen, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
which kind of, and I think after, like, as I got further along in my career, I actually learned, you know, it's not always a live remote. And
right,
some things actually don't
exactly.
have to happen. And whenever you have enough information to make a decision, yes or no, sometimes the answer is no. And that is the right
Yeah.
decision.
Oh, that's so good. And I think, like, you know, with producers, we always run out of time. Like, the deadline, and it's like journalism, you know, anybody, I guess, like, in a weird way, we've chosen this. We chose that environment because we need somebody else to tell us when it's time. Like, no, it's got to go on air. So it's never done. It's got to go on air. If the Oprah show was still going on in Chicago, we would all still be working there. Like, it's just true, you know? And like, so what do you do with that when, like, you're someone who is kind of wired or orientated or engineered or predisposed to chase that? Give me a deadline, because I love a deadline.
Yes.
Okay, well, then you have to self-edit when there's other things where it's like, okay, maybe not this. Like,
right.
Maybe not this. But producers, you know, we make something out of nothing. So sometimes when there's nothing, we keep going until there's something. And that's not always the best course to take, you know?
Right. It worked there, but it doesn't work everywhere, which was a big lesson for me.
Bingo. Bingo. Yep.
Nope. One thing I really love about you that I think is obvious to just about everyone who is in your orbit is that you have a very clear and obvious commitment to authenticity. You will say the things that need to be said. You will speak your truth. I don't see a lot of fear in you in terms of being willing to say the things that need to be said, both as a human and in your work. So can you say a little bit more about that? I would love to hear what you have to say there.
Oof. I'm scared all the time. All the time. I think my therapist years ago said I have a low distress tolerance. So I don't like to be in places of conflict. And so I think that wanting to not be in conflict leads me to try to circumvent or prevent the conflict from happening in the first place. Now, there's a lot of ways that can show up. But I do think that, like, again, in the moment, that's going to be the best time to try to say the thing that needs to be said, because it will grow into a bigger thing that really needs to be said later, right? And so, but gosh, it's funny because I have heard from a lot of people, friends, colleagues, that I am, like, fearless, and I have such a, like, a gosh, you just, like, have no fear about these things. And I think it's so funny because I'm like, I am scared all the time. I told you I'm a little woo-woo. So there's a philosophy, I don't even know actually what you would call it, called human design, where you can kind of, like, get your body mapped with all these, I don't even really know what I'm talking about beyond I get interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
And, my chiropractor, like, someone at the chiropractor does it. Her name's Patty. She's wonderful. And she's like, all your fear centers are all lit up. I've never seen anybody with all of these just open. And I said, well, what does that mean? And she's like, it means you're going to feel the fear, but you're going to do it anyway. And I'm like, that's great, because that's how I feel. I don't not have the fear, but I sit with it and figure out what I'm going to do with it next. And sometimes really poorly, to be clear. Like, I am not, again, don't have to be perfect, just have to be whole, which looks like challenging those, you know, all the little doubts and all the little what ifs and just kind of having to say, well, what's the next right move? We talked about that at Oprah all the time. What's the next right move? How do we do that? And then how do we do the next right move after that?
Yeah. I think that is such a, I know it's something I think about a lot personally about feeling the fear and doing it anyway. I think that is such a vital life skill to help you get the most out of life while also thinking, being thoughtful, not just being that person running headlong into everything. Because sometimes fear teaches you things. It gives you information to consider, you know, as you make your decisions in life.
Absolutely. If you were not afraid of getting hit by a car, like you cross the street and you would die. Like fear is a good thing. And we, you know, again, like I said, everything comes from Oprah. Two fear quotes that come to mind are the Gavin DeBecker gift of fear.
Yes.
Love him. Yes. And then I think Marianne Williamson said something about like, you know, there's only two reactions, fear or love. So like, which one are you moving towards? Every decision is an act of love or an act of fear.
Yeah. That has been real meaningful in my life too. One of the shows I worked on at Oprah was Super Soul Sunday. So I'm all into all this stuff.
Oh, that's right. I love Super Soul Sunday, Heather. Oh,
so I'm into all of this. And just to let y'all know, so everyone that worked at Harpo, we all still stay in contact. And I mean, we it's a thing. Like it's a whole culture. Most of us work there for over 10 years. I would say it was rare to start there and not be there at least 10 years.
Yeah.
So we went through a lot together and it was a tough job. You know, there were all nighters, I would say at least once every 2 to 3 weeks. You know, it's a tough job. We spent all our time together, but there are a few, I guess, inside things that we talk about. One of them is the Gavin DeBecker, the gift of fear, because he came on this show and his most famous thing that we do still bring up to this day is never go to the second location.
Never go to the second location. In fact, there was a really funny 30 Rock episode where Alec Baldwin says to Tina Fey, like, never go with a hippie to the second location. It was like a nod to Gavin. It was so funny. And I just thought, oh my gosh, everyone from Harpo would just like laugh so hard at that, because you get never go to the second location. You fight. If you, anybody listening, you ever find yourself, I hope you never do, in a situation where your life is at danger of being attacked, you do not go to the second location.
Yeah.
You do not. You, that is the place you fight.
Yeah, that is the critical moment.
Get in the car or whatever. Yeah.
That's a no.
Lord, I'm getting chills just.
I know. I'm getting my like nerve centers are all lighting up now. But that show is famous for anyone who ever worked at Harpo at any point.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about storytelling and the craft there. Now, your career has been really interesting because it is nonlinear and you've had the opportunity to go in and try a few different things, challenge yourself in a few different ways. You have been in entertainment, agency, in-house. And I love that. I love a nonlinear career because I think you just learn so much that way. Can you say a little about what you've learned from working in those different types of environments?
Yeah. You know, I often say to people that your career is like a pyramid and you don't know what is at the top of that pyramid. You know, and nobody takes a straight path, just straight up the middle, right? You kind of like meander, you know, and you might kind of go out to the edges or the fringes of the pyramid, then you kind of come back to the center. And I really feel like the biggest lesson for me in my career path has been, I just follow my curiosity. I follow what I'm curious about. And you know, that intersection of what you're curious about, what you like to do, what you want to do, what you're good at, you know, and then ultimately, gosh, if you're lucky, like, what does the world need? Like where and why is this a good fit in a partnership, you know? And I think I had a mentor at Publicis who said, you know, I don't work for Publicis. I work for Jill, you know, he used his name. And he said, I'm in partnership with Publicis.
That's awesome.
And, you know, at any point when that partnership no longer is a partnership, then it's time for me to kind of evaluate. And it's a beautiful thing. Like, and we go back to like knowing when to say no, or knowing when to move on from things. You know, I think that we all have this inherent sense of knowing when it's a good fit, right? Knowing when, and that doesn't mean that every day you like wake up and you're like, this is the best job I've ever had, and this is amazing, and I'm so like, I'm only doing things that I want to do. I'm never doing something I don't want to do. No, but like, on a day-to-day balance of, you know, the seesaw, things are even, you know, what you're giving is what you're getting. you're learning, you're growing, you're kind of in your flow state. And we all know when we're out of that flow state with anything, but sticking in the career zone, like, you know, when you're just kind of out of your flow with something. And to me, that's a signal to say, huh, okay, what am I hearing? Like, what might be next, right? And I think, you know, when you layer that on top of, you know, just the time and the industry or industries that we're in, everything is coming together, right? It's very squishy, the world of entertainment, advertising, marketing, content, branded content, original content.
So much.
You know, like, there's so much. And everybody, you know, has the ability to be, you know, if you're a writer, you have the ability to have the same reach as the New York Times. All you have to do is start a blog. Like, you can be CNN or MSNBC, start a podcast. Like, there are so many ways to get your work out. And then I think, you know, when you are a creator and a storyteller, there are so many companies and industries and organizations that need you, you know, and I think really kind of trying to not limit, I would say, yourself to thinking about how the outcome has to be. Oh, I'm a writer, so that means I have to write books.
Yeah.
There's a lot of writing to do in the world. It could be, I mean, honestly, like, you know, using your writing skills in emails is an important job that helps connect and communicate people. Like, and we shouldn't diminish that or discredit that because it's not a Pulitzer Prize winning novel. You know, so I would just say, like, staying curious about what interests you, not being so, like, landlocked to saying, well, I've only ever worked in agencies, so I'm an agency person, or I've only worked in TV, so I got to stay in TV, or, oh gosh, I would never do a corporate job, or I've only been in corporate jobs, why would I go to a nonprofit? Like, you know, just kind of being curious about, you know, the impact that you can make.
Well, you're making me think too, post-Harpo, and actually on a personal level after my divorce, like, this is a lesson for my divorce that actually has impacted my career in terms of my mindset, being a lot more comfortable with duality. While outcomes are king, especially when we're talking about business, we are driving towards a goal and that goal needs to exist. It is also true that the road getting there matters. How we get there matters. The things being open to learning and adjusting and pivoting even on that road to the outcome also matters. And I think I used to be very binary about this is what needs to happen and that's all that matters. And I think it's deeper than that. My position now after more years in my career is to be much more comfortable with duality. The road to that outcome matters to my mind as much as what the actual outcome ends up being, and being open to changing what the outcome is supposed to be as we learn more along the way.
100%. And I think that's, you know, it comes with a lot of wisdom and a lot of lessons, right? And I think, like, again, producer brain, we're both, you know, forever producers, like, producer brain is get it done with what you have and chase towards the goal because the thing is airing, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, my brother is in the Navy, Airborne Division, and he and I have a very similar brain. Both operations minded. He just happens to be, like, military, and I'm creative. But there's a concept called the OODA loop, OODA, and it is how you make sure you don't crash your plane. And it is observe, orient, decide, act. Observe, where are you in space and time? Orient yourself to, you know, I'm here and these are the conditions that are going around me. Decide, make a decision. Am I going to go left, right, up, down, etc.? And then act. Then you have to make that action. Here's the key. You have to do it over again. So in this, you know, in the producer scenario you're talking about, we made an observe, an orient, a decision. And the decision was this show is airing. And now we go act, and we act, 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 act until it happens. But in the OODA loop, you cannot base the next action on old information because you've changed where you are. not only have you moved physically into a different place, but the conditions around you have changed. Now it's raining, now it's hailing, now there's a plane coming at you. I don't know, whatever it is, those are different conditions. So you need to make a different decision and then you act. That's the next right move. Then you have to do it over again, right? And so I do feel like that is a big lesson that I have also learned professionally and personally, that we are always co-creating and that we are always in concert with not just where we are, but where the world is. What is the conditions around you? How have they changed? Like, you are a heart surgeon and you get your hand cut off. You can't do heart surgery anymore. What are you going to do? That doesn't mean your passion, maybe your passion was heart surgery, but maybe your passion was healing people or helping people, or meticulous craft, or, you know, academia. I don't know. There is a path for you beyond that when the situation changes. And I think it's our job to just be in partnership with that. And really it kind of takes the pressure off, right? Because it's not just on you. Yeah. It is, you are a part of something, but not solely responsible.
Wow. I love that. I've never heard that before. And I love that whole idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use that.
I know, it's good, isn't it? This is what my really brother good. And I talk about when we are able to get together, which I love.
I love that. Now, I think I'm going to move us on to DEI, if that's okay, which is something you and I have talked a little bit about. We both worked at Harpo for many years together. And one interesting thing about that culture, which was very noticeable, and you've talked about this before, is that it is a significantly diverse environment. And I've never been in that type of environment ever since. If anything, it veered hard into a woman-led environment, which is something that I haven't encountered since that position. So what was the adjustment into corporate America, which is different than that? What was that like for you?
LOL. LOL, it's so different. I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but Harpo was like my second like big kid job, like actually with a paycheck and a 401k type role. And then I was there for a decade. And so I spent like from like 22 or 23 to 33 there. And, you know, I can't overstate the importance of that being my formative work experience, to be in a place of a ton of diversity, you know, female, you know, so many women, LGBT plus, Black and brown and parents. And I mean, there was just such a rich multitude of that culture with a Black woman leading the company. And by the way, not just any Black woman, Oprah Winfrey, you know, uniquely. And I just can't overstate, I can't even really put into words how it was not, I mean, we didn't have a DEI initiative or club or metrics there. It was just, gosh, and I can't even really say, I'm really kind of at a loss for words to say how important that was. And then to go into, you know, shifting into corporate America, I mean, I just remember thinking, oh, this is what people are talking about.
That's what
this
I
is
thought
what everybody
too.
Meant when there's like, you're the only, or you're the only something in the room, or, oh gosh, we have to have a meeting about this. Like, let's just do it.
You think about
again, not only intentionally, and I don't even know if intentional is the right word, you know, working at Harpo was a reflection of the show, right? And so we were talking about this stuff. So not only did we have kind of the criteria of diversity, check, 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 but the content, I mean, the times I sat in edit bays with, you know, a lot of cis male white men, and we talked about sexism and racism and, oh my gosh, like, how did this happen? And what about this? And, you know, I mean, just some of the the subject matter and the topics were so rich and deep
Yeah.
that there was not time for that surface level of isms, you
Yeah.
know? And then again, coming into kind of corporate America, I feel like I came in on the other side of the ravine. I came in at a, you know, management or leadership position that so many women and people of color and historically marginalized people fall through because they can't
Yeah.
get over to the other side of that management gap. And, you know, I'm so thankful for that experience, for that alone, let alone all the other, like we've been saying, all the other wisdom that we gained from our time there.
Yeah. When I remember too, at times sitting in meetings, because also the group of people that worked with Oprah were also very brave and said, you know, part of that environment is you have to say what you're thinking and you have to say it right now. There's no like waiting whenever something's going on. I remember being so appreciative. Things would happen or someone might say something or do something that really was not okay. And someone would check them on it immediately, not even like in a mean way, but it was just not, it wasn't acceptable. And it was very clearly not acceptable. And it was different going into post jobs and looking around the room and just realizing I was in a very different environment at that point. I don't know. I'm just like sitting with all of that, thinking about that right now, because I didn't think about that till you had brought it up. And I was like, you are so right.
Yeah, no. And honestly, you know, I do talks and stuff on DEI and diversity and inclusion. And I've sat on councils and I've, you know, participated really thoughtfully in this debate. And, you know, the reality is like, it's not a company problem or an industry problem. It's an America problem, and it's not an America problem. It's a world problem. And it's like, you look at all of the history of the world and like, gosh, we're only a little baby skosh into talking about widening the narrative and widening who gets to play in corporate America, you know? Like, I mean, I don't know the statistic offhand, but there's only been like a handful of people of color who have been
Yeah.
CEOs of Fortune 500s. There's only been a handful of women. And when you look, you know, my experience uniquely as a Black woman, I think there's been like three,
Yeah.
you
Yeah.
know, in the history of all the Fortune 500 companies ever.
Yeah.
And it's like, you can't say that that's not a problem. Like, there's not something else going on, co-creating. It's not just me. It's not
Right.
just the person. It's not. And that's no shade on all the, you know, other people who have gotten to be CEOs. But it is like, hey, let's look at the weather. Let's look at the environment. What are the conditions that
Yeah.
are you know, causing people to thrive or to not?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've also, to that end, you've spoken quite a bit on the topic of gendered racism in a few different venues in advertising. You know, so can you kind of talk a little bit about how you think about that in our work and as a leader, as it is a clear issue?
Yeah, I gave, I was part of a talk at the 3% conference a couple of years ago. And we talked about, you know, I think that our title was like Black Female and Stressed AF or something.
Yeah.
Like
see,
that
I think,
because...
yeah, I think it was, the title was Black Female and Stressed AF. I think if I remember correctly.
Yeah. And we talked about, you know, gendered racism. Like, as I mentioned, I love academics and just am a forever student. So I was taking a class, psychology class, and learned about this idea of gendered racism, which is, you know, we have sexism. Everybody knows that. We have racism. Everybody knows what that is. But gendered racism is kind of this holy third thing that only comes uniquely from the intersection of gender and of race. And so I think it's Melody Hobson who tells the story of, you know, being at a conference and being mistaken for the help, you know, being asked what the meal was going to be at lunch or whatever it was, right? And it's like, that is something that's uniquely Black female of, you know, being mistaken for the help, being of service, You know, Black women are over-sexualized, they're under-sexualized, they are, you know, the angry Black woman kind of schema. You can't be too angry, but you have to have your opinion. You can't be too docile. You know, like, there's so much that goes into it. I think that, you know, the flip side of that gendered racism is, like, for Black men, people who cross the street when they see them, because there's a, you know, an over index on violence that you wouldn't put on a man of another color or a female of who is Black. And so, you know, certainly, again, it is in advertising. I think the specific kind of challenge or opportunity is to make sure that the stories that we're putting out, the narratives that we tell, who's telling the stories, et cetera, are not just through one particular lens. But again, I say, you know, advertising gets a bad rap. Hollywood gets a bad rap because, yeah, we're putting out the content. But it is beyond an industry problem. It's so seeped into, you know, our entire culture and, you know, just our history. And I think we all have to, you know, reconcile with that. I think all the time, gosh, like, you see a news headline and you're like, where's the Oprah show on this? Because we would sit down and say, you know, one of our favorite promo lines was like, insert what happened. Where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. Where do we go from here? Like, that was always the question that we were asking in the interest of getting everybody better, you know? Yeah. So to kind of go back, I think, like, you know, the gendered racism, gosh, it just starts with, like, people understanding what that even means of, like, wow, okay, that's something that's even beyond what I know about sexism, what I know about racism. You know, and it stems, I mean, I have my experience as a Black woman, but it stems to, you know, all cultures, you know, and all races. It's kind of crazy. And there's a woman, I think her name is Kimberly Crenshaw, and she was a lawyer, and she was the one who coined the term intersectionality, like, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in my research on gendered racism, she came up, you know, as really describing the nuances across race and gender and class, right? And how those things kind of intersect to create your experience and, you know, the shared experience of how we kind of interact with those intersections.
Yeah. I remember I heard about this for the first time in college because I took a seminar on Ida B. Wells, and that is where I learned about white feminism and how it is. And it was just something I'd not encountered before. So I learned about this older when I was in college, and we had a whole discussion on what intersectionality is and about the weaponization of white feminism and what that actually has meant in reality over history. It was, I mean, it was deepening of some knowledge. Yeah, it was deep. And, you know, and I remember, I think I was 18. It was like a freshman seminar. And I remember, and I grew up evangelical in the middle of Texas. So these were things that I was taught in a way that was not correct. And I remember that was my first introduction to maybe I need to think about things differently. And that was my first moment of thinking about that, I remember.
Yeah, it's that where, you know, the O and the O. Who am I and where am I in this, you know, in orientation, in observance of what's going on around me? It's not about me. And I think, like, with the intersectionality, there's this beautiful kind of wheel of intersectionality that, you know, you can Google, or I'll send it to you if you can see it. But again, when we put anything at the center of it, make ourselves the center of the universe, like, we've missed out because we're only telling from that perspective. And it's like, oh my gosh, there's this whole beautiful wheel of intersectionality across so many different touch points, and every single person contains multitudes. And when we start to just compartmentalize, see our own little place as the only place, not only is it dangerous, it's just like kind of a dull way to look at life. There's just so much more. So much more richness out there, you know?
Yeah, it's the opportunity to either experience in a very small way or in a much big life in the world is so much bigger and richer than most of us are open to seeing, I think, at times.
Yes. And isn't that what creativity is about? Is cracking that and opening that and showing that to somebody, whether it's in comedy or tragedy or drama or a beautiful piece of art or a music that hits you and you don't know, like there's something rich about good creative, you know, good creativity and good creative. And it's because the person who created it has put their essence in it. You know, you can feel it. You can feel it.
Yeah. I mean, this is making me think about the core of what creativity is. Cause every once in a while, I'm sure this has happened to you too. You'll run into someone says, oh, well, I'm just not creative. And I always push them on it. And I say, no, everyone is creative. Cause you know what creativity is? It's your life. It's all your feelings. Yeah. It's all your thoughts. It's everything you want. It's everything you've been through. That's what creativity is. And, you know, and we all find ways to express that, whether it's the way we talk, or maybe some people have a craft, they write, they paint, they create things, or it comes across in their mathematical skills, or it comes across in their job. It comes in the way they interact with their friends. Like creativity is actually your life. It's being human. So I like to push people on that a little bit, because I think creativity is such a deeper thing than paintings and words and music. Like it's actually, there's a lot more to it. And there's a lot more depth to it, I think, than some people think about.
Yeah, I love that. And it's like, if you ask a classroom of kids, you know, who in here is an artist, most of the kids will raise their hand, you know, and there's a very specific, you know, there's a very specific time period when they stop raising their hand. And every kid starts out drawing and coloring and creating stories and playing with their toys. And, you know, the collective society kills that. You know, and it's a shame, because everybody, to your point, like even if you are a mathematician, there's so much creativity. Math is a language. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Math is a language, and math is shortcuts, right? Like 4 + 4 = 8, or 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1, you know, is 8. Like it's just a shortcut. It's just another language. I'm very bad at math. I don't understand the language, but I appreciate the beauty of it, you know? And I feel like, gosh, if we could just keep people's creative spark fed, you know, going back to like leadership too. And I love what you said with like, hey, like there's not really a space for your like claymation hobby or whatever it is that you like to do, but keep doing it. Keep doing it. Because it makes you a better, you know, professional. It makes you better at what you're doing, because you're, again, you're feeding your whole self. And like, gosh, anytime we can encourage that, if we could all just be like 1% more of that, you know, I think we would change a lot of things.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of truth to that. But so usually I ask this question, I'm going to tell you how I usually ask this question, then I'm going to ask it in the Oprah way, because I know you're going to know what this means. So usually I say something like, what has been the biggest lesson or takeaway of your career? I'm going to ask you, what do you know for sure?
Oh, but I know for sure. I just got chills. What I know for sure is that this life contains infinite possibility. You know, because we live in a space-time continuum, things happen within time and within space. They have to, right? We set time to have this conversation. And if we wouldn't have set the time and the place, it wouldn't be happening, right? So we have to recognize that. But because things happen linearly, in between one thing happening and the next thing happening, in between from action to action, there is a chance to make a different choice. And there is a chance to pivot, and there is a chance to do something that you didn't think you could do. And I think just like that possibility of the present moment, knowing that we have agency and power. Now, am I saying like, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, $50,000 in debt and I don't know where my next paycheck is going to come from? I can just infinite possibility my way into, you know, a McMansion in the suburbs. No, I'm not saying that at all. But is there always a little bit of room to do the next right move, to make a better decision, to push something creatively that you're passionate about into the world, to be a little more curious, to say no to something, to say yes to something? Like, yes, we have that power. And it's just like such a beautiful gift. And that is what I know for sure.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you for being here today. I really appreciate you coming in. I love these conversations because I always learn like 800 things every time, and today was no different. I know you have a very busy day, and so I appreciate you making the time to come in.
I'm so happy to be here and to chat with you, and it's a great way to start my day. So thank you.
And thank you all for listening, and we will be back soon with more interviews talking about brand storytelling, career, leadership, all those fun things. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen. Ready to level up your next version? You can find more Final Final at www.heathermcgee.com or at Instagram with Final Final the Podcast. We are also available for one-on-one coaching and consulting. Send a note to Heather at heathermcgee.com to learn more.